Delicious meat, nutritious. Crack into a good source of protein with tasty, healthy, Wonderful Pistachios. Wonderful Pistachios is a complete protein, providing all 9 essential amino acids. In fact, each 1 ounce serving of Wonderful Pistachios contains 6 grams of protein. Pistachios have got to be the tastiest nut. Pistachios are delicious, they pack a nutritional punch, and are oddly fun to eat. It's like a little dopamine drop every time you hear that shell crack open. Personally, I like them roasted and salted, but you can find your favorite shell or no shell variety at WonderfulPistachios.com. Whether you are running between meetings or dropping off the kids, Wonderful Pistachios are the snack that works as hard as you do. Check out WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more about this healthy, tasty snack. It's springtime here, which means it's mattress season, and mattresses are sprouting up everywhere I look outside. I'm kidding, of course, but if Mother Earth did grow mattresses on trees, she would grow avocado green mattresses, as they use sustainably sourced organic natural materials. As the season also brings the warm weather with it, I'm quickly reminded how important temperature is to our sleep quality. Staying cool overnight makes a big difference, and organic natural bedding sleeps cooler than the cheaper synthetic alternatives. For those who thought avocado only makes mattresses, they also make the most luxuriously soft bedding to keep you cool and comfy while catching those restful Z's. Whether you are looking for organic cotton, natural linen, down, or even silk, Avocado Mattress has everything you would want to upgrade your sleeping environment. Investing in better sleep always pays off. Head to avocadomattress.com today to save 10% on all bedding and 50% on clearance bedding. Avocado, dream of better.
I know when I'm not feeling completely at peace, it's like a punch in the face now. Whereas most people, they've normalized suffering, they've normalized being tired, they've normalized being frustrated, they've normalized being in a dysfunctional relationship, they've normalized being in some state of dis-ease. And so just through the laws of relativity, anything that stands out from that isn't necessarily as blatant.
Peter Krohn, thanks for joining me on the Mindful Movement Podcast.
It's my pleasure to be here.
I was stoked to see your folks reach out to us. I've consumed your content.
Yeah.
With a side of hash browns. I've taken in a lot of your content over the last several years.
Yeah.
And I've always been impressed by your skill set, like your ability to communicate what I find to be really important ideas around psychology, I guess.
Yeah.
And just have a very clear way of presenting them. And I've always appreciated listening.
Well, I appreciate that back. It's not lost on me whenever I go around the world. I was actually just in Europe, and it was fulfilling, surprising, and always gratifying to be stopped as many times as I was. I was even between flights on a connection, and sort of, as is often the case, we have to pick up the pace a bit because we're a little tight on time. And here I am in a sort of very gentle jog, and this woman came running after me, and I wasn't sure if I, you know, forgotten my ticket or something. She said, "Oh my God, I just had to say you changed my life," and it's just very sweet. So, yeah, people often, similar to what you shared, say, you know, I make the profound very palatable. So I'm happy to do that.
Yeah, well, it's true. You have a skill set for sure. I was preparing for this, and I was diving back into some of your videos and just kind of getting reacquainted with some of your messaging, and something hit me like right out of the gate. It was like spiritual evolution is, I hope I don't botch this. It was like chipping away at everything but yourself, or like everything until all that's left is you, or no, everything that is not
isn't
us.
You.
Everything that isn't you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that like hit me, and I just kind of meditated on that for a little bit in my backyard. And it sounds really simple, but there's like a lot there, I think.
For sure. You know, I'm often, again, flattered by people's compliments, and they say, you know, it's not like I'm hearing something completely new that what you're sharing is sort of familiar with other teachers or books I've read, but there's something about the way you said it just suddenly lands, and now I finally get it. You know, and so, and I'll often back that up by saying, yeah, it's very simple. It just doesn't mean it's easy, right? So, pointing out truth is what I like to sort of point to is something that resonates with us as human beings. It makes sense. You know, that doesn't mean that you just suddenly can transcend all of these habits and conditioned patterns that you've had for decades of self-sabotage, right? So it's one thing to be able to reveal the truth. It's another thing to actually integrate it and make it part of your everyday life. So I think that's where I like to bring a lot of compassion to the human journey, which is we're all doing the best we can within the limits of our awareness, you know? And so whilst I can point out things quite, you know, articulately and certainly in an inspiring way that people want to attain whatever it is I'm talking about, I also do like to give the caveat that, you know, give yourself some patience and grace that you typically, my audience is going to be 30, 40, 50 years old. And so you got some pretty serious habits in the way of whatever it is that you just got inspired by. So it's both.
Yeah. You just alluded to such a powerful concept, the compassion, like the idea of giving yourself some space and I guess really understanding that whatever habit you have or whatever is arriving in you, like there's a reason for that. And it came from somewhere and it's not necessarily a problem, but there's a lot of value in being able to reflect on why it's there, where it came from.
Yeah. No, I think that's really the journey we're all here to engage in. And as far as I'm concerned, the true opportunity that is to be human is to break free from, ironically, the patterns and conditioned limitations that make us human, right? So I think it's, again, it's a fascinating opportunity to recognize the divinity, the essence of consciousness, the absolute, or whatever word you want to use, the spirit, the soul that we are, but simultaneously make space and be, you know, patient with oneself to recognize that being misidentified with the human form is, it's normalized. You know, of course I'm this height and this age and this weight, you know, even though that always changes. So I often let people understand that anything that can change can't be you, right? Because you're the consistent. And what is that you? Is it, some people use the word, the observer, the witness, pure consciousness, presence. And so for me, the journey of being human is really that misidentification being revealed so that we can come back to the true essence of who we really are, which all sounds very poetic and highfalutin, but I like to try and make it very practical too, that, you know, as long as you say things like, oh, I am fat, or I'm depressed, or I'm a loser, well, you've just created your own prison within language, and it's going to be very difficult to get out of that if you're the one declaring that, right? So that's why I get sort of into the semantics of language and recognizing, as I often say, words are the wardrobe for the soul. You know, it's just that most people aren't wearing a very flattering wardrobe.
Well, you spoke of freedom, and I see that a lot when you like go to your website and such. Like, what are you pointing to when you say that? Is it just the ability to kind of disassociate those two things? Like, whatever is that constant that is, you know, being housed in that me suit and all those narratives, all those stories or identifications that you layer on top of it?
Yeah, I think, you know, freedom's got obviously many different definitions depending on who you speak to. But the one that I'm sort of helping people discover is freedom really from suffering, which last I checked is it's a pretty good thing to be able to share with people. So it's and then recognizing where does suffering initiate from. And it's typically the misidentification with form, right? That I am this body and I am the thoughts that this brain generates. And so it's really freedom to be in the absence of any constraint, freedom to not be at the effect of life, because most people, unwittingly, are victims of circumstance, right? They're like, oh, well, I feel bad because, fill in the blank, my spouse said something, my kids did or didn't do something, my boss, da-da-da, or politics, this and that. And so people are under the impression that they feel a certain way because of something. There's no freedom there, right? You're a victim of circumstance, which ipso facto explains why people have control issues. They want to kind of control circumstance because that makes sense, right? If circumstance are the generator of my experience and I want to experience a good life and I'm under the impression that the only way to do that is have circumstances a certain way, well, then I'm going to try and control circumstance, which, you know, leads into people-pleasing, manipulation, perfectionism, all the things that people do. But it's also exhausting, and why then people get, you know, depleted, exhausted, and resigned. And so my freedom is all about letting go of that and being totally at peace no matter what.
How do you think you do it that? Like, you clearly have a skill set. They've labeled you the mind architect.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you're within your own mind, working from that framework, like, do you have a process where you're, like, checking in to see how you might be, like, creating these, like, labels or stories about yourself? And, I mean, it's easy, like, because I know for me, I could see it all over the place. I mean, yeah. Since I've been listening to people like you or, you know, learning a bunch of stuff over the last 10, 15 years, like you see it everywhere around you, people behaving in a certain way. And then you practice a little compassion. You think about like, where did that come from? Why are they doing that? Some understanding. But do you have like a checklist almost in your mind to like check in with yourself of how your actions or behaviors or thoughts or ideas are being affected in ways that you're not as free as you think?
I wouldn't say I have a checklist. I think there's a couple of things that are working in my favor. One, I've been doing this for a long time. I'm the one that sort of downloaded these perspectives, not saying I did that, but life, for whatever reason, saw fit to use me as a channel for these different distinctions. So I'm immediately a beneficiary of these insights. And then secondly, I'm having these conversations pretty much on the daily, right? Whether I'm working with people that I help in business, sports, entertainment, or clients, or I'm running my workshops online. So I think just by virtue of having these conversations consistently, they really have become second nature. So I don't have a checklist per se. I tend to default more to how I feel, right? So what that means is, I've become sufficiently proficient at understanding how I feel when I'm free to just by sheer comparison, notice when I'm not, right? Like as a very crude example, you know, when you're cold and you know, when you're hot, because the body's got sort of its default factory setting of what is the right temperature for you.
Right.
And so I guess I've established that for myself as it relates to my emotional and psychological wellness. I know when I'm not feeling completely at peace. It's like a punch in the face now. Whereas most people, they've normalized suffering. They've normalized being tired. They've normalized being frustrated. They've normalized being in a dysfunctional relationship. They've normalized being in some state of dis-ease. And so just through the laws of relativity, anything that stands out from that isn't necessarily as blatant. So using an analogy, if you have a t-shirt and you played rugby, soccer, football out in the yard for many, many years and the t-shirts become soiled, you can, you know, drop a couple of pieces of dirt or ink on it. It doesn't really stand up or stand out. Sorry. Conversely, you know, you wash the t-shirt so it's pristine, or you have a brand new one that's white. Anything that is, you know, the opposite of that or not white is going to stand out. So for right. me, my checklist is really my state. When I'm in a state of peace, then the world can be doing what it's doing. People say what they say. My affairs are the way they are. And I deal with the things I want to, and I don't deal with the things I don't want to. It's quite simple.
Right.
When
you
I
have a reference.
Yeah, exactly. I've got this new kind of foundation of what it is to feel free, at peace, and what I would assert in a state of love, you know. And so anything that upsets that apple cart of my own mental health is it's quite apparent for me now. So then that itself becomes an opportunity even for me in the way I look at things, because I tell people that life will present you with people and circumstances to reveal where you're not free, is one of my quotes. So if even myself, Peter Crone, God forbid, I'm human for a minute and I get pissed off by something, which hasn't happened for a long time. But, you know, there can still be a potential trigger. Then I only see that as an opportunity to discover even more freedom, right? What is it that I'm saying I'm not okay with? Because that's the lie, that there's this underlying sense of fear, or that humans look at things as a perceived threat, that they're in trouble or they're not going to be okay or they're not safe. And these are the things that I'm undoing for people so that we can be in a state of peace no matter what's going on around us, which is also synonymous with being powerful, right? Like somebody who's easily upset, we could say isn't very powerful. So all of these bedfellows of being free, being at peace, being powerful, being loving, and having a true sense of possibility, I feel fortunate that is my typical state.
Nice.
Yeah, it doesn't suck.
I feel like I spend a lot more time there than I used to, but there's still,
yeah,
you know, there's still always work to do, it seems. I don't know if there's ever really a summit to that mountain for most. Try to enjoy the process along the way. You said, yeah, over the reps and the time that you kind of downloaded these perspectives that you deploy to your clients and to the world. Is this like a skill that emerged out of some like pain, or is this just like a natural thing that you gravitated towards? Does this go way back to like childhood, or?
Yeah, I'd say both. I mean, my story is, it's, you know, something I've shared readily. I've got nothing to hide. I mean, my mum died when I was 7. My dad went to work when I was 17 to work on the ferries between Dover, England, and Calais, France, and Belgium. And the boat capsized, and he was sadly one of the many that passed. So, you know, by the age of 17, I'm orphaned. I'm an only child. So that was a pretty significant incident for any human being. It set me up in ways that I didn't fully comprehend at the time, but I became incredibly vigilant. So at that point, being by myself at the ripe old age of 17, I just, as a, you know, pure instinctual way to survive, I became incredibly observant of my surroundings, because there isn't this sort of backdrop of safety or being held by a parent, which I think is, you know, for any dependent child, is a luxury, a necessity, and hopefully something that most kids have, but I didn't. So I think part of my skill set is, very early on, it was from sheer survival that I was really, really vigilant at understanding words, behaviors, actions, and monitoring things around me, albeit from more of a perspective of self-preservation. Once I then got beyond that and realized there was nothing to survive, I'd still develop the skills of paying attention to things. So I could see the subtlest change in someone's facial features, their breathing patterns, their body posture. So that was part of it. And then certainly in my late 20s, I was in a relationship that ended. And it was, for me at the time, sort of the first real experience of love, like where I thought, oh, this could be the one, and all of these stereotypical expressions people have in relationships. And so she left me after about a year and a half of us being together. And unbeknownst to me, it really was the catalyst to reveal this deep story of loss that I had not actually reconciled from my parents dying. And so that really became a portal into a new world that I didn't even know existed, where she left and I struggled for a while. I definitely was in my own state of suffering, couldn't sleep, calling buddies, you know, how do I get her back? Desperate men doing desperate things. And I had these incessant questions that kept going around, like, where is she? Is she dating someone else? Will I see her again? Will I find love like that again? All sort of melodramatic questions. And one day I got the answer to all of them simultaneously, which was, I don't know. I don't know where she is. I don't know if she's dating anyone. I don't know if I'll see her again. And I don't know if I'll find love like that again. And it was so categorically truthful that it sort of short-circuited the part of the mind, the ego, that is always trying to seek security. You know, those questions were being generated from the part of us that doesn't feel safe, that is concerned for its own preservation. And at that moment, it was sort of the death of that part of me, because I realized, oh, I've never known what was going to happen. Nobody does. We're all freaking clueless. It's just by virtue of being human, with the primordial imperative of every mammal being to survive, that we're always trying to figure it out as a means to survive. And it was just so categorically clear to me that the nature of life is uncertainty. The nature of being human is to try and find certainty, and the paradox of those two. And so I stopped playing that game. And it was the most liberating experience I'd ever had in my life, was to be totally at peace no matter what.
That sounds like a really useful Practice. Be at peace no matter what.
Yeah. If you know, if you're into that kind of shit and you don't want to suffer and get sick and have arguments with the missus, yeah, sure.
It's funny. I think about something during that you mentioned you were able to like pick up on postures and different like feedback from someone when you're talking to them. My son, we were talking briefly before we hit record that my son had moved out like last year, and a few months ago, I have a gym, so I work in a gym environment, and I was there, and I got a buddy that's using the gym like regular there, and you know, I've been going through something since my son left that's, I guess, you know, been a puzzle that I've been working through in my mind, and my buddy just like comes up to me, he's like, "You all right, man? You sad that Cosmo left?" And I was like, it dawned on me like, oh yeah, I think I am.
Yeah.
And like, I needed somebody to like see something in me. Like I was going through with all these struggles and not being able to like see myself at all. But people, you know, we are always communicating with each other, whether we're using our words or not. And, you know, we need each other to like hold the mirror up at the right angle, at the right distance, so that we could see and be like, oh yeah, I am. I should, you know, feel that.
Yeah. That's beautiful. And it speaks volumes about the love you have for your son. You know, it's really that to me, the sadness. And when people actually lose a loved one, or that's the narrative they use, they don't lose them, but someone might pass or leave or die or whatever. You know, grief, sadness in that regard is really just an extension of love. It's really quite special, you know. So your opportunity, I would say, not that it's, you know, solicited advice, is to just see the sadness as really the antithesis, but the same, the opposite side of the same coin, which is, you know, just how much you care about your boy. It's beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. Yeah, I think like just parenting in general creates like really weird pressures that we create on ourselves that we don't see easily aren't there. And like, I know I got sick back in like 17, Lyme disease, had a rough go at it. And I remember like it really bothered me to be sick. It was like, there was all this fear around not being there for them.
Yeah.
And I remember trying to piece it together, like, when I was young and my parents split up and feeling like my dad wasn't there, it was like out of fear of like, I want to make sure I am there. You know, I'm like taking the lesson. I found the opportunity and the lesson from like the way I was parented to be like, okay, I know what I don't want to do.
And,
so it was like fear that I wasn't going to be able to do that job and be there for them. And then like when they leave, it's like, did I do enough?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's an endless opportunity to beat yourself up or second guess yourself or maybe even resent yourself. And it's a weird challenge to go through. It's like, I feel like I'm in a phase now with the kid, like that transition to empty nesting, like your whole sense of self-worth almost changes because you spent, you know, all these years anchoring so much of your self-worth to doing the parenting things and making sure they're okay. And they might not be okay. Like you said, I don't know if I'll find love again. Like it's a freaking illusion anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's beautiful. I appreciate you sharing because I think there's many people out there, especially in your audience, who are parents themselves, and parent guilt, especially for moms, I think is, you know, it's a real thing. I think kids can be such incredible teachers. And oftentimes when we're at a stage in our life, you know, 30s, mid-30s, late-30s, where sometimes the resignation has become so thick, you know, there's this feeling of like, what's the point? You know, you've been through enough relationships that failed, probably been through a couple of job opportunities didn't work out or a startup that didn't go anywhere. And I think when you have a kid, again, I'm not speaking from direct experience. I don't have any, but I work with plenty of, you know, adult children with my clients. I feel like I can sometimes be that quintessential father figure for so many. And I just feel the unconditional love that a parent feels for this extension of them, this little being that they co-create with someone hopefully they love, it's very revelatory, right, in terms of this newfound capacity to really transcend one's own selfish tendencies, which every human has, and really put, as you said, all your energy into tending to this other being. It's really quite wonderful. But at the same time, you can lose yourself in that, right? And this empty nesting experience, it can, you know, question your own worth. You know, well, what am I doing now? I know a lot of women, because it often coincides with perhaps their biological changes, premenopausal, menopausal. And so there's this, well, what's the point? What am I here for now? You know, and I think children, they're just such a gift, you know, like we obviously all were there at one point. And I feel like for you as obviously a big softie at one level, it's beautiful for you to see the gift of your son and what he helped to reveal in you and your capacity to show up, your capacity to love, your capacity to sacrifice. And those skills, you know, as I was speaking to earlier, even though I learned to be hyper-observant when I was orphaned, I still got the skills. I just don't need to come from fear anymore. So, you know, maybe you can apply the same philosophy to yourself. You got the skills of care and consideration and self-sacrifice and going above and beyond. And now maybe you just get to apply it to something else, whether it's your wife, yourself, God forbid, you know, or somebody else who could use a friendly hand. You know,
it's funny. I've been channeling it into like hobbies.
Yeah.
Like learning guitar, woodwork. I'm like filling my time with it.
It's
interesting. It's weird though. Like, yeah, I would think that if somebody asked my kids, like, how, you know, is your dad a good dad or whatever? Of course. Like, he's plenty good enough, you know, room to spare. But internally, like, the felt experience is, there's something part of me that's like telling myself a very different story.
Yeah. And that's what I was speaking to earlier. That's the part of us that I'm helping people break free from, because it's just a narrative, it's a dialogue. That's the part of you that isn't you, but is the resistance. You know, you work in a gym, you said, and so obviously to get stronger you need to create resistance, right? Hopefully within that sweet spot where you're lifting enough weight that it's not so easy you're not getting any growth, but it's also not so heavy that you're creating injury. And so I think for the psychological and emotional growth of resistance, we need a dialogue and a narrative that can at times be self-deprecating, and we use that as a way to strengthen our tolerance, our capacity, our tenacity, and to realize, oh, hang on a minute, is it true that I'm not enough? No, I did the best I could. It doesn't mean I'm perfect. Nobody is. But it's through that understanding that you develop the compassion and the surrender to the fact that everything that's transpired to this point can be any different, because it isn't. And that includes how you parented or how you didn't parent. And there's just such a beautiful, coming back to that word, sense of peace in that. That, you know, that's one of my most popular quotes. I say, what happened, happened, and it couldn't have happened any other way because it didn't. And talk about a way to reconcile history, which is what most people are dragging around, constantly trying to fix. You know, it's a futile task.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
Remember when I talked about True Diagnostics True Age Test? Well, I took it myself and the results are in. I found out my biological age, which directly predicts my risk for serious diseases. Here's why that matters. Research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. The good news is, nearly 90% of biological aging is in your hand. Yes, it's driven by things like your lifestyle, which means you have a lot of control over it. I was pleased to see my biological age was 6 years younger than my chronological age. That felt like a big win, because I've definitely put a lot of time and attention on improving my lifestyle habits so they are more aligned with my health goals. The test also showed a few areas to work on and even pointed out a low level of riboflavin or vitamin B2, which plays a huge role in energy metabolism. It's strange, because I felt there was something inhibiting my energy, and now I have a simple theory I can test. The True Age test didn't just give me a number, it showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging. The test itself was super easy and convenient. I did it from home, no doctor visit or big needles, just a quick, painless finger prick. You send off that tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to TrueDiagnostic.com and use my code MINDFUL to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's TrueDiagnostic.com and use code MINDFUL at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. So what are the, like, when you go about working with somebody to like unravel some of these things, are there certain like modalities that you pull from, or like what's like the strategy that you generally take to kind of get to help somebody walk through a process where they can find that peace?
I guess that's part of, you know, whatever my proprietary skill set is, that I downloaded these, what I consider 10 primal prisons of the subconscious that everybody's got as part of their factory default settings. You know, what you just alluded to, the I'm not good enough, or I'm not loved, or I'm not safe. I haven't declared all of them or revealed all of them yet, because that's going to be in my book.
Oh, okay.
But you know, many of them are very relatable. People are like, oh yeah, I'm always worried if I'm going to be okay, which creates fear and anxiety. So I think having that deep understanding when I'm working with anyone, or in my mastermind, which is a really powerful 3-month container I do with a group from all around the world, and I coach people live, and then I'm teaching people what I'm doing. I'm listening to somebody express their concerns, their problems, whatever they're dealing with, but I'm listening from the perspective of like, what is the underlying constraint that has that problem exist, if that makes sense. So somebody might be talking about their health, their relationships, their finances. And as humans, we really don't have that many topics of conversation. We're all pretty basic, you know. It's okay, the details change, your wife's name is different, your business is different, but it's still in the arena of I want to be loved, I want to be safe. It's still the same thing. So my strategy, to call it that, is I listen very astutely, and I hear where people are saying things that then immediately give me insight to what might be their primal prison that they're stuck in. And then my job is sort of like a magician to reveal the constraints, ideally from their own perspective. So I'll ask very thought-provoking questions to help them see, oh, wow, shit, yeah, I've thought like that since I was 3 or 4. Okay, well, what was maybe the event that transpired then? And, you know, typically a memory will come to the surface for them of, wow, I can remember when my dad said this, or my mom did that, or, you know, I accidentally hit my sister and I thought I was a bad person. Whatever, stuff that kids do that is just everyday kid stuff. But it can create an internal dialogue that defines somebody for the rest of their life, you know. And so that's what I'm undoing. So that's my process. As I tell people, I don't solve problems, I dissolve them. And that, I think, is a very unique approach, whereas most people go to an expert to find solutions, you know. And I've often pointed out, well, if you're looking for solutions to your problems, you're just reinforcing the fact that you've got some.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I went through definitely a process like that over the years, maybe, you know, not in a like quick kind of compact session, but just fumbling through it myself, I guess. And a lot of it stemmed from like finally quitting drinking. Yeah. So that I could even have the clarity to like look back at the younger self and see, mm-hmm. Oh, I see. Like, and I would get those memories. Like, I remember this memory would come up where I'd be at the doorstep and my dad would have his like suitcase in his hand and he was mm-hmm. leaving. And I could like see myself as like a 5-year-old watching that unfold, like confused, like what's going on. And then mm-hmm. later seeing that, oh, I formed beliefs that I wasn't good enough. I wasn't like worthy of his love, because if I was, he would stick around.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, you know, beliefs, behaviors, and actions, like we're just all born out of that, whether Absolutely. It's like self-sabotage with drugs or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's powerful, and it's really wonderful that you're able to make those connections, because that is the access to freedom, right? To see, oh, in real life, there's a grown man that you call dad who was standing at the front door with a suitcase. That's, you know, I'm not denying the facts of that. But then what do we do as humans? We create a story that is relevant to us about the circumstance versus, I don't know, he had an argument with another grown adult that you called your mum and he was like, I'm out of here. And that had nothing to do with you, you know? Right.
Yeah, it was just like them having a dysfunctional relationship. But as like a kid, you don't have the like cognitive function to piece that together. It's all about you.
Everything. And that's, you know, that's the beauty of this dimension of being human is that we all curate the events that we need to, as I say, sort of emotional epigenetics. You know, people understand epigenetics now in terms of like, you know, which proteins we turn on and off based on our genetic makeup because of the lifestyles we lead and the foods we eat. Well, for me, emotional epigenetics is very similar, where we will curate the events that will turn on the different levels of sort of insecurity, inadequacy, or scarcity that we all have. But we collapse that with the event versus, no, that's why I'm here as a human, is to transcend that. I arrive thinking I'm not good enough. And so your soul, without sounding too esoteric, generated the circumstances so that you could feel that, so that eventually you could get beyond it. And that is, as far as I'm concerned, the raison d'etre of being human, is to break free from the constraints with which we arrived, is the way that I phrase it. Mm. And that's a much more empowering game versus, no, you're a victim of the fact that your dad left and he didn't give a shit. You know, well, now you're at the effect of someone else's choice. And that's why, you know, it's kind of you to share. But what have you dealt with drugs or drinking? You know, we find any means of escape, which is really just to try and placate the suffering, which is the byproduct of the way we view life, not realizing it's the way we view life. Like, we made that view up, you know. And when you see that, it's like, holy shit, like, I'm literally the one creating my own suffering.
Yeah, for sure.
Not that smart.
So I don't want you to like spill all the unknown that's going to be in the book. You said there's 10 primal prisons that you kind of, that everything kind of boils down to in the scaffolding that you're working through here.
Yeah.
Can you speak to one that maybe is, that like people wouldn't quickly consider, that might be like one that you wouldn't see coming, that you see shows up on folks?
Yeah, it's a good question, because a lot of people often will say, what's the common ones, you know, which we sort of touched on, like not being enough somehow. Everybody can relate to it. Might not be not good enough, it might not, you know, not pretty enough, smart enough, skinny enough. Everyone's got their version, but in that realm, I'd say one that's a little more insidious and perhaps not so obvious is I'm not safe. And it plagues women way more than men, but it's still there. It just manifests in different ways. For women, it's, you know, relatively obvious why a woman might feel that, given centuries of abuse from men over the years, you know, witches being burned at the stake, to obviously, sadly, rape and sexual abuse that has happened for centuries towards women. So even now, a woman leaving a dinner party and it's dark and she's walking to her car, she's going to feel, relative to a man, much more scared, you know, because what if there's a guy walking down the same side of the sidewalk? You know, it's sad, but the not safe, it's insidious because it's become, again, normalized. Like, you know, don't talk to strangers, we tell kids, right? Like, which is a subtle way of saying the world is dangerous. I'm not saying it's not good advice, but it's the subtext that gets imprinted into kids' minds is, you know, you just got to be really careful where you go and who you talk to. And again, I'm not saying that that isn't the case, but it's really a sad reflection on the society we've created. So feeling not safe, or a feeling of insecurity generally, is where a lot of people struggle with anxiety, social anxiety, fear. And so that's something that even your listeners right now, hopefully they can see, is a big component of the fabric of their own identity and personality. And to maybe consider, it's not a truth. It might be a worthy strategy of how you navigate the planet, but the millions of human beings who live in the world of I'm not safe in their mind, who will never encounter anything that justifies them feeling that, it's staggering, right? If you think about like how many people will get to the end of their life and they were never kidnapped, stabbed, raped, molested, mugged, you know, but there can be sitting that same sensation of any of those pending threats. It can be there 24/7. And that's the deleterious effects that create sickness over time, because people are living within a hostile environment based on the way they perceive life. And again, I have compassion for it. I get it. But the part of the formulaic way that I help people find freedom is we want to investigate the validity of that view. Like, is it an actual truth that you're not safe? Or did you grow up in an environment as a kid where your parents screamed a lot, or your dad would, you know, come sometimes get angry and break shit? You know, for a kid, that is going to create a feeling of I'm not safe, or this is a dangerous environment. You may well have removed yourself from that 30, 40 years ago, but still live within the energetic sort of signature of that. And so that's the opportunity that I bring people is, you know, what becomes available if you didn't walk around thinking that you're not safe? Well, fuck, I'd feel so relieved. Well, that usually is a, you know, good precursor to having a healthier vitality, better sleep, and typically less reactions in your life and your relationships, you know. So, and the cascade of that over time is, you know, usually another 5 to 10 years of living. So you might want to stop looking through that lens.
Yeah, that, what did you say? The energetic signature of that you're carrying around. It's like all the cells in your body are listening to that.
Yep. Yeah. And when people see that, it's really both liberating, but it's also, for some people, it's disconcerting, right? Because they're like, holy shit, like, I didn't even know I've been living like that for 40 years. And it's, for me, because, you know, much of my background was in biology and exercise physiology, and I study Ayurveda, which is a healing modality of yoga, like Chinese medicine. And to me, the most powerful piece of equipment that is both the instigator of sickness, but also the means by which we can reconcile it, is our perspective, our mind. And, you know, I'm speaking at a biohacking conference next week in Austin, and everyone is all about their peptides and their, you know, their hyperbaric chambers and all the toys, right, that people will spend tens of thousands of dollars on. And I'm that pain in the ass guy in the room who's speaking. I'm like, listen, you can spend 200 grand on all the greatest technology, but if you don't free your mind, you're not going to access true health. And it's quite revealing for people. They're like, holy shit, like, yeah, I've been walking around thinking I'm not enough, I'm not safe, whatever it is. And when you live inside of that mental construct, you're, as you said, your cells are in a mild state of fight or flight consistently, which means that without getting into the, you know, biomechanics of all of that, you literally don't rest, you don't digest your food properly, you don't rejuvenate cells properly. That's all contributing to the aging and disease process, right? So you can eat all the organic food, have a chef, do the training, all the things, but if your internal terrain is one of a mild state of survival all the time, you are, you know, going to go through a process of degeneration whether you like it or not.
Right. But we're also, I guess, kind of addicted or with like what's familiar. So
yep.
It could be terrifying, even if you like to consider, like, what if I woke up tomorrow and I did feel free, or,
yeah,
and you didn't have all these things that you were, I don't want to say like clinging to or identifying with, but like, they're just so ingrained. We're such habitual creatures that, you know, your brain might literally be addicted to like that composition of chemical makeup that is that fear. And maybe even some of those stress hormones that are being, you know, modulating the way you're making energy based on that fight or flight response. Yep. You have, like, those for some people feel good.
It's the ultimate addiction. Again, I write in quotes. You know, you said you're familiar with my work, so maybe you've heard some of them. But I say, you know, being right is the poor man's version of self-worth.
I've definitely suffered that. So I definitely have a history of, you know, trying to prove my, like, validate my worth by trying to be right in yeah. relationships. And it's a terrible strategy.
It
I'm
is.
Better at it, but, you know.
Yeah. And what it's pointing to, and why, again, these quotes sort of instinctively, inspirationally come through me, is to point out what's so, right? Like, what are we doing? I'm just pointing out the reality of what it is to be human. And you realize, wow, when someone's trying to be right, even at the expense of their often financial abundance or their relationship passion and intimacy, you know, but they're going to fight to be right. when you really break it down, it makes no sense because you're jeopardizing the life that you might otherwise declare you're really committed to. But what you're actually doing is you're wanting to sustain the ego's constraint. That's what being right is about. It's not even you. It's the ego that is trying to justify its own limitation. And when you see that, it's both revelatory, oftentimes embarrassing, but hopefully simultaneously inspiring the end of that insanity. You know, it's like, wait, why would I want to prove to people that I can fuck up my life? Right. The number of people who do that, like, you know, quite eloquently.
But that same part that drives that, like that same part of the ego that allows that behavior to rise, probably served a good purpose at some point.
For sure. I mean, again, the ego, every part of what it is to be human serves a role, right? But I think, you know, I made this joke with a friend of mine recently who had gone back and forth in a relationship forever. And as often people do, you know, similar to the point you're making about familiarity, right? The familiarity of the same person, you know, their tendencies, their idiosyncrasies, you're comfortable being naked with them, you know, what it's like to be intimate with them physically, and you can deal with it versus the fear of meeting somebody else. And are they going to like me, or are they going to see my muffin top, or whatever people might fucking worry about? You know, I get it. And I used the metaphor. I said, no, your relationship, and this might, to, you know, sort of the untrained mind sound a little bit callous, but, you know, relationships are really the means by which we get to evolve. And she'd gone through the evolution, but she wasn't willing to step into the next level and the next iteration of herself. And so I said, you've got to recognize in this case, because the relationship had definitely served its purpose, it was like an Uber ride, you know, like it's useful. You need the Uber to show up to take you to your next destination, but then don't just keep getting back in the car. You know, it's served its purpose. You know, and for her, that was what she needed to hear. It's like, holy shit. Like, yeah, I'm where I actually wanted to be courtesy of this relationship and everything that she'd learned from it. But I keep looking backwards as opposed to, you know, really employing and integrating the things that I learned from this and using it as a precursor to the next evolution of what a relationship can be for me. So, yeah, that's where the ego does serve its purpose, but you got to get beyond its, you know, lessons when they're done, as opposed to still staying in the, oh yeah, well, my brother was the better athlete, so I'm obviously a loser. Okay, well, maybe that was good for a minute because you became competitive as a teenager and you really wanted to beat your brother and, you know, you just wanted to get some more attention or validation from your dad because the dad used to adore the brother because he, you know, whatever, fill in the blank. But then you're in middle management and now you're competing with the guy next to you who's got a bigger budget or he's making more sales and, you know, you're burning yourself to the ground, which is really still the same mechanism that was just trying to garner love from your father because your brother got more attention. You know, and it's like it just doesn't serve you anymore. So, okay, yeah, that's, I can get it as a kid, but right now it's, you know, it's actually, it's deleterious to not only your performance, your health, but your overall joy in life. So they serve their purpose, but, you know, once you've utilized whatever means it is to survive, you know, move on and hopefully discover more freedom so you don't have to beat the shit out of yourself.
Yeah. But, you know, we're all walking around with probably so many of those little aspects and little and like the relationships between us and not just ourselves, but how we look at everything else and all the people in our life. Like there's a lot of moving parts. It's a very, you know, there's a lot of dynamic systems interchanging all these little things. And it's easy in life for many people probably to go through, especially when you're driven by, like, you know, productivity and like doing shit and like getting your tasks of the day done.
Yeah.
To not be able to connect with what's going on underneath and,
yeah,
I don't know, say go through the motions, but like kind of continue on and let all that stuff fester.
100%. I mean, humans become very mechanical, you know, and that's where I think people check out before they realize that they're in a job that they don't enjoy and they've done it for 25 years. They're in a relationship where there's no passion or joy, you know, and they've done that for 15, 20 years. And, you know, these are these midlife crises or where somebody has, you know, perhaps something that is quite dramatic happened to them physically, you know, their sickness or a heart attack, or, and they've sort of been asleep at the wheel. And as I often use humor in my quotes, I say, you know, for the most part, the only thing of any significance missing from anybody's life is themselves. You know, when you really get that, it's like, oh shit, like the subconscious can, you know, it could get you home drunk as a skunk, you know, which I'm not condoning. I think it's horrific. But, you know, how many people have done that because they know how to drive a car, they know where they live, and their body is taken over, even though their presence is, you know, just not at all there. And so this is an invitation to what degree are people truly fully engaged in what they do in their life. I mean, even the way people eat, you know, I can remember once I gave a workshop, this is many moons ago when I first started my career, at a golf, beautiful golf club. And the title of the workshop was how to lower your handicap by chewing your food. And I thought it was a great marketing strategy because people are like, what the fuck? I just got to go to this just to see what the hell this guy is going to talk about. And it was really just pointing to presence, you know, the fact that most people just waft food down because they have some sensation of hunger. They eat more than they need. They don't chew it properly. And it's really just trying to mitigate the feeling of hunger. They're not necessarily nourishing their body. They're just trying to get rid of a feeling or a dissatisfying sensation. So in this case, you know, with the golf handicap, it was like, you know, to what degree are you checked out because you hit a bad shot? Now you're pissed off and you're not even paying attention to the next shot, you know, and so it becomes a snowball effect. So to what degree are people really present in their life? You know, it's a great place for people to start to look.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we call this channel the Mindful Movement. Like, to me, mindfulness is just that act of, like, paying attention to what's going on right now.
Yeah.
In one of your videos, you said, can you be okay with the way everything is right now?
Yeah.
Which is, like, a really good question to ask yourself, especially if you can pause when, you know, whatever's going on, you consider mayhem. Like, you've attached the problem there, you know, that there is a problem. But, like,
yeah,
can you be okay with it the way it is right now?
Yeah. And that's, again, the opportunity to see where you're not free. Because if you can't be okay with the way things are, then you're saying that I'm at the effect of life. And that, you know, in deeper, subtler, primal terms, there's a perceived threat. You know, I'm not going to be able to pay rent. I might get fired. My partner might leave me. And I'm not going to be okay. That's really what's at the basis of people's reaction to life, is the fear, again, of not surviving something. But you're always going to survive. I tell people, you're always going to survive until you don't. So there's nothing to worry about.
Right.
Worrying about whether you're going to survive, that's exhausting.
Yeah, there's something about letting go, or like that act of surrender, you know, yeah, and trying to give up a little of the control.
Yeah, which is really giving up the part of you that doesn't feel safe. And that's, you know, for a lot of people who follow religion, which is fine, that's their means of, you know, they might call that faith, right? And for me, it's more trust. You know, I often joked, even though my parents passed and I was an only child, that I'm actually a trust fund baby. I wasn't left a penny, but I trust in the universe.
Well, seems to be working for you.
Doing okay.
Tell me about some of these. You said you do workshops. Are these like in person? Is this virtual?
I do both. We started not that long ago. I think about 8 months ago, we started doing live events, which has been so fun. And it's something I thoroughly enjoy. It's brought out a different side of me. I become more of a comic on stage, which is
nice.
Entertaining for everybody. But yeah, so I do live events, a couple of hours where people come along and I'll riff on something to begin with, and then I work with people in the crowd, which is quite fun because I never know what anyone's going to share, but everyone can relate. Then online, I have my three and a half months now, a mastermind with 8 modules, super powerful. That's where I teach my philosophy of what it is that I do. It's sort of not quite a certification, but as close as it could be, you know, without actually getting a certificate, where I teach the methodologies that I use. I do theory in the morning and then I coach people in the afternoon, and there's a whole community. There's feed. I have 3 mentor coaches that work beneath me that hold conference calls to integrate, because I tend to download information very quickly. So it's a really powerful, life-changing journey. And then something most people really love to start with is my Freedom membership platform, which is like a archive of all of my courses. Is over 100 hours on everything from how to free your mind, how to free yourself from anxiety, depression, what is a real relationship, what is true health, how to create financial abundance, all of that. So, and then I have a wisdom library of like, I think 100 clips that people can just check out. And there's also Q&As. And so that's something that people, you know, love, because it's just their means of accessing very affordable self-development, self-realization work to get themselves out of their own way.
Gotcha. And you also said you're trained in Ayurveda?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you actively practice that, or is that?
I do. Yeah. I'm actually going on, I've been invited on a big cleanse in 2 weeks in North Carolina, which I'm looking forward to with one of my favorite doctors. And
what does that entail? A cleanse? They just squirt stuff in and push everything out? Or?
Yeah, basically, that's the lay way of putting it. It's called Panchakarma. Pancha means five and karma means action. So there's five actions in traditional Ayurveda that we use. And cleanses are traditionally supposed to happen between the seasons as we shift from one season to the next. Of course, in Western world that we all live in, nobody has the time to do that. But I try and do one once a year just to reset, to get rid of the accumulation of toxins, which are unavoidable by virtue of the world we live in, you know, whether it's just the foods we have, the microplastics, that, you know, the chemicals that are sprayed everywhere, whether it's in the sky. Yeah, just a lot, right? So, so yeah, you do everything from oil massage to busti or enemas, and eat a very clean diet with a prescription of special herbs that are, you know, customized to whatever it is that you're going through. Fortunately, I'm not necessarily going through anything, but I just tend to be very proactive in being optimized. So I just like to keep my meat suit as clean and functioning as well as possible.
So what do you get out of that? Like after, how long is that event?
This one is 7 days. I think it's 6 days. Yeah. Yeah.
That sounds kind of intense.
It is. It's a commitment, you know, and that's again why I only do it once a year. Because like you, I'm a busy guy living my life, trying to free the minds of millions of humans around the world who are suffering. And
for the record, I'm not that busy.
Okay. Good to know. That was an assumption on my part. But well, I guess now if your kid, you have kids, you had two or?
Two kids, and they take, they don't need me much. They don't really need me.
Okay, good. So you're in the new chapter of your life where you can
transfer funds here and there, but you know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm definitely busy, but I'm looking forward to taking this little sojourn and tending to my vehicle. So, 6 days. And the days are structured where you do these oil massages. I have to do preparatory work where you, what's called, oleate your body with ghee, which is a purified form of butter to sort of loosen all the toxins in the body so that you can excrete them. So the benefit is you feel lighter, usually more inspired, you know, more present, better sleep, all the things that, you know, most products out there are claiming that you'll get when you subscribe to their product.
Gotcha. I mean, when you do that and you do this kind of intense, really like physical detoxification, I mean, do you come out of there with kind of different outlooks? Like, is there like a mental or emotional component that kind of pair that you winds up emerging from kind of going through that?
100% can happen for sure. I think for the more seasoned Ayurveda cleansers like myself, typically it's more a physical sensation of feeling lighter, brighter, and all the things. I think for some people, there's a lot of stored and trapped emotions that can get sort of liberated during the process of the cleanse. Just like when people go to a breathwork class, you know, people can really break down and cry, and a lot of trauma can be released. So I don't anticipate it. I'm always open to it, but I feel for me, it's very much a physiological process. But what it does give rise to cognitively for me is a greater sense of clarity, maybe a little bit more motivation. You know, there isn't that sort of lethargy that can happen over time as we accumulate things that maybe the body doesn't need. So that has a degree of an emotional, psychological aspect to it. But for some people, yeah, it can be very, very intense, but at the same time, very, very freeing.
Is there like a electronics kind of fast that goes with it? Are you kind of off screens during that time? And
I mean, with any of these things that they do these days, there's no hard and fast rules. They encourage certain things. I think just naturally people who are doing a cleanse are going to be a little bit more checked out from their everyday life. So I know, I mean, I just got back from a vacation that I haven't had for a long time. And, you know, I was barely on my phone. It was really nice. So I think as part of the cleanse, I'll probably do the same. And they definitely encourage that. But they're also a business and they recognize that people have their days and their lives and their families and their employees to check in on. But it's definitely encouraged because that would be another form of toxicity for sure.
That sounds like, I wouldn't say fun, but it sounds really productive to go through something like that. I think a lot of people never even really consider things like that. Like it would sound very extreme.
It is. For a lot of people who are, certainly people who aren't familiar with Ayurveda, which is, to me, it's such a beautiful science. It's over 5,000 years old and it still makes allopathic medicine look like complete child's play. You know, like I think many people are waking up to the pretense and the propaganda of Big Pharma these days and realizing that, you know, a pill for every ill isn't anything to do with health. And so it can seem shocking when people are used to their annual checkup, someone in a lab coat, and then, you know, having whatever, I think the average is 4 or 5 medications that somebody takes, you know, whereas Ayurveda is quite the antithesis of that. It's actually a beautiful distinction that we make is that the greatest doctor, which is called a Vaidya in Ayurveda, in Sanskrit, the greatest doctor is the one who has no patients, right? Not you know, his ability to be with time, but he has no one who's actually sitting in his clinic because he's educated his community on how to take care of themselves. Versus in the Western world, you know, it's like people are like, oh, who's the popular doctor? Who does everyone go and see? It's like, well, how fucking good can they be if everyone keeps going to see him? So that's one of the main distinctions is, yeah, for people who aren't familiar with it, it can seem intense. It can seem shocking. But actually, when you get into the fundamentals of it, it's really beautiful and it makes complete sense, you know. And that's why, for me, I'll often say I'm an expert in health, you know, not an expert in disease, which is what a doctor is.
Right. Well, people are waking up, as you said. They're asking different questions, and they're starting to get better answers.
Yeah. You know? No, and it's really nice to see, because I've been sort of screaming from the rooftops a lot, certainly through COVID and all of the nonsense that was going on, you know, and to begin with, okay, there's a bit of resistance until, you know, finally people are like, wow, thank you for letting me see what I couldn't see before. And I like to break it down in very simple terms. I mean, if you look at the genesis of what it is to become a doctor, you know, there's sort of 5 main pillars of their education, right? They study anatomy, which is the form of a body. They study biology, the physiology, which is the function of the body. They study then pathology, which is where things go wrong. And then the intervention is pharmacology. And then lastly, you might specialize and become a surgeon. So you basically become a doctor with all the best intents. It's not a reflection of humans who want to make a difference. It's beautiful, you know, good people in allopathic medicine. But it's not healthcare, it's sick care, because a doctor is an expert in problems. I work with a ton of professional athletes, and I often would use the metaphor of taking one of my MLB, you know, baseball players to a new coach. And he's like, okay, well, who's this new coach? I'm like, well, he specializes in striking out. He's like, well, why the fuck would I want to go and see him? Well, precisely my point. Why would you go and see a doctor to learn anything about health?
You know? Yeah, you know, it's a lot of good people stuck, and they're just handcuffed in a system. Yeah. It's not that the system's broken. It's just that, I mean, the system's great for certain things.
Yeah.
You know, if you're laying on the street and your, you know, spleen is on the street next to you because the car, you know, I think you want allopathic care, putting that thing back in.
100%.
But when it comes to like the chronic illness that seems to affect just so many people now, they're not structured right. The system's not structured to ask the right questions.
No. For interventions, emergencies, triage like that, 100%. I'll be the first to send flowers and thank you cards to doctors and nurses who saved my life, believe me. But for what it means to be a healthy, vital human being, that's got nothing to do with the medical system.
Right. It's funny. I have a client that I was working with a year or so ago, and she's a physician. And like early on in the sessions, I was talking, you know, she had like low energy. She had a lot of like low energy symptoms, I guess. And I started talking about like the relationship of food and physiology. Yeah. And it led down to like this idea, you know, revisiting like cellular metabolism, essentially. And I drew like, you know, mitochondria and Krebs cycle and electron, all that stuff. Yeah. And she made a point. She's like, you know, in med school, we had to memorize all that stuff. Like we knew all the steps and all the cofactors, but they never taught us how that related to feeling good or helping someone feel good.
Yeah.
And it's like, that kind of sums it up. It's like, you know, it's like that drawing that connection of, you learn the biology, but the system, the business model is not connecting that to like thriving health or optimizing health.
No, and again, as I was saying in the sort of steps that I outlined, it's because step four in terms of the treatment is pharmacology. So, okay, here's a problem. What's the solution? It's a drug, as opposed to let's revisit diet, lifestyle, and mindset, right? That's where Ayurveda to me is so beautiful, because they have there's an expression in the philosophy, which is with good digestion, medicine is not necessary. With bad digestion, medicine doesn't work. And so they recognize that, you know, to your point, and I love that you know everything about that, or you've obviously studied something to do with Krebs cycles and mitochondria, is that, you know, when we're in a state of stress, as I was saying earlier, and you're in fight or flight, your digestion system, just by virtue of the autonomic nervous system, isn't working properly. So then you're not actually digesting, assimilating, and metabolizing food, which is the means by which you fuel yourself. So again, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to recognize, wait, if I'm in a mild to severe state of stress, I'm not nourishing myself, I'm certainly not sleeping in a regenerative way, then of course, if that happens over years, maybe decades, again, I'm going to be not well.
Right, yeah. Yeah, stress in the short term can help produce more energy to help you survive the stress, but chronically, stress and metabolism are inversely related.
Absolutely.
And metabolism kind of governs everything, because all the systems in your body are all tapping into like share the central system of make energy, like take food and make energy out of it.
Yep. Absolutely. And that's why, you know, for the most part, the diseases that we see out there in the world, you know, cancer, diabetes, the cardiac world of, you know, disorders, typically it comes down to like poor metabolic health, you know.
Yeah, there's at least a metabolic component to all of them, all the things that take us out.
Yeah. And to me, then prior to that is, you know, why I feel I'm very blessed to be in the position I am, is the perspective people have that generates stress that leads to all of that in the first place. So, you know, freeing your mind.
It's really important. Like in the gym for years, people come in and they're trying to look for like a gym, like a fitness solution to things. But the older I got, the more reps I got, the more I realized that like, we're just going to layer stress here onto your existing stress. Like there's, you know, there's stuff between your right ear and your left ear that need to get worked out eventually if you want to kind of get the results you're looking for. And I live in an area where there's just like a lot of productivity driven lifestyle where there's just like stress everywhere. And to the people have just no idea. They have no idea what they're already carrying. And and there's, you know, I think there's real pivot points that can occur when you work on the emotional and mental stuff that generally seems to all trace back to something when we were younger, like way younger.
Yeah, 100%.
And it's a hard thing, but it's super valuable.
Yeah. Again, why I say I dissolve problems, I don't solve them.
Right. Well, Peter, I really appreciate you taking your time today. It's great to meet you, quasi meet you through the internet here. And I hope for the listeners, you got something out of it. Always grateful for your listening. And to find out more, petercrone.com is the place to go.
Website, and then Instagram at Peter Crone. Yeah.
All right. Looking forward to whenever the book
finally drops.
Very interested. Thanks again. Have a great day, everybody.
Les, thank you.